open the floor for discussion. So I think we have just one microphone over here. I'm not sure if we have someone else that might circulate a microphone, but, you know, as in the past, these panel discussions are really meant to engage you all in conversation. So not just didactic presentations talking at you, but talking with you and talking with each other. So hopefully we'll encourage folks to come and engage in conversation. So without further ado, I want to introduce our first speaker is Joseph Amon, who's a medical epidemiologist in HIV Care and Treatment Branch, Division of Global HIV and TB, Center for Global Health at the United States Center for Disease Control and Prevention. And we'll also introduce Bruce at the same time. So we'll have Joseph speak first and then Bruce. And Bruce was here this morning, gave us a fantastic plenary. So again, I think needs no introduction, but Bruce Agins will talk to us about the work of New York Links. So we'll go ahead and get started. And again, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Michael, and good afternoon, everybody. I want to give you a brief presentation about how we at the Division of Global HIV and TB using a quality assurance effort to improve our programs on the country level in our country offices. Many of you here may know this, how CDC works as a technical partner and as a funding agency through PEPFAR in the various host countries. We have CDC personnel, technical personnel in the countries, and we work with local and international implementing partners and directly with the ministries of health, who then, receiving the funding through cooperative agreement, provide either technical assistance to health facilities, and these technical assistance examples are supportive supervision, clinical mentoring, or site-level quality improvement, or the support that they provide is called direct service delivery. In addition, if they do direct service delivery, these partners not only provide the technical assistance as described, they also are providing salary support for additional healthcare workers and or purchases commodities. The implementing partner is present at the sites at least once a quarter, and the CDC in-country staff has the responsibility of oversight of the partners. An important part of the oversight of the implementing partner by our in-country personnel always have been and are site visits. As we count these patients as U.S. government or PEPFAR supported, we have a responsibility to monitor the quality of the services these patients or beneficiaries receive and also work constantly to improve these services. Secondly, there is a contractual obligation or responsibility. We are accountable for the U.S. government taxpayer spend through these cooperative agreements, and we have to ensure that the implementing partners providing the activities and fulfill the agreed on the agreements. As a technical agency, CDC also provides direct technical expertise and assistance. Oftentimes, our personnel is directly embedded in the ministries of health. We work with the ministry-led technical working group to provide that direct technical assistance. Providing that technical assistance and expertise included from the beginning and the onset of PEPFAR always ongoing site monitoring by the U.S. government staff. Under the leadership and the vision of our then division director and now Ambassador Burks, CDC implemented a systematic and standardized system, the Site Monitoring System, or SMS, in 2012. To systematize and broaden ongoing site monitoring processes and improve the documentation of that oversight. It was implemented in 24 service delivery countries, and it covered the CDC-supported PEPFAR sites. As Ambassador Burks became the U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator, that system was expanded in 2014 to all PEPFAR agencies and is now not only supporting activities at the health facility level, but also monitors services support, that are in the community and also site-level services that provide more guidance and support on the above side level. For example, institutions and partners we are working with who are involved in guideline development and distribution or supply chain management. So the SIMS as a quality assurance system has three tools: the facility, the community, and the above side. It defines standards across all of the PEPFAR supported areas. They are also called core essential elements or CEEs. And the US government staff through SIMS assesses these services against these standards. It's done in a very collaborative and transparent way. We share the tools and with our partners, the site, the ministries, and it really has as the backbone a supportive supervision approach and strives for improvement. The US government staff that conducts these visits is trained across all program areas, and you see here an example of one of the standards regarding adherence support. It's a series of yes-no questions that they build on each other. Some standards include a very limited chart review or a register review. Normally, they also ask for verification of documentation and materials so that there's a visual verification. And depending on the specific PEPFAR support at the site, all applicable CEEs are scored on a graduate scale from red, meaning urgent need for improvement, yellow, improvement, and then light green and dark green, meeting or exceeding the standards. This slide gives you just an overview of all the programmatic areas that are covered in the health facility tool. And I want to point, get to your attention that there are standards in quality management and quality improvement. So through the technical assistance that our implementing partners provide to the site, there's an expectation that these partners implement quality improvement activities, either using an existing quality structure, if there is one on that the national government has rolled out, or if not, then they should apply their own quality improvement methods and also institute a routine system for review of and use of performance data. So after the SIMS assessment, what are we doing to making improvement happen, to make change happen, and how are we working with our partners towards that change? There are different times, levels, and forms, and I wanted to start off by the immediate site feedback. And really, improvement starts here. The site involvement and the feedback are critical components of SIMS, and the site receives a same-day feedback in form of a dashboard. You see here an example. It's very low-key, and a debrief. And I'm saying this in the debrief. Everybody, all the actors and players are together. The healthcare facility staff, our implementing partners, as well as the U.S. government technical personnel, but also, and I have not mentioned that yet, in general, somebody from the government, from the provincial or the district health management teams is accompanying the U.S. government staff. So some of the solutions or kind of the issues that we are, and kind of like tackling the issues that we identify, we can start right there, right at the time of the debrief. Quality assurance versus quality improvement, two very distinct but intersecting components of a comprehensive quality management program. SIMS is a quality assurance activity by definition. We are assessing activities and against standards. But the issues and that are identified through the quality assurance activity, really some of them lead to quality improvement projects, and where the site then really goes through the standard test change cycle of a plan, do, study, act. So again, it really depends on the issue identified. If it is a one-time fix, or if we can work with our partner to, let's say, if the site does not have the newest or latest ART registers, we can work with our partner, with the district health management team, to ensure that the site gets the necessary registers. Is the issue, let's say, partner testing of HIV-positive patients, for example, that then really may lead more to a process improvement, a root cause analysis, and a more detailed measuring of the process itself and of the improvement. So these issues can become topics of quality improvement projects. The projects are supervised by our implementing partners through their regular technical assistance, and so the implementing partner is really the facilitator of this improvement. If an issue or a gap that is identified occurs in multiple sites of one partner or across multiple partners that the agency involves, then really our country staff and has to ensure that an improvement that is made at one site is mirrored in all the other sites the implementing partner supports. So we have that multiplier effect of one improvement across all the sites. And I just put on one example that also works from partner to partner. Oftentimes we have international partners and also local new NGOs and CBOs as our partners. So if there is something that an international partner has already implemented, the new local partner does not have to reinvent the wheel and can just learn from them and use their materials and copy them. Some of our offices have now instituted a monthly meeting of all the partners around a certain topic where the partners bring their data as well as the government, that the U.S. government or CDC, the collected data, and they discuss it in one forum, and that's where the partner-to-partner exchange really happens. This is just one example of a quality improvement project as a result of a SIMS assessment in Katiani sub-county in the hospital in Kenya. They scored low in March 2015 for the HTC referrals to HIV care and treatment standard. They had received prior quality improvement training, the staff, but the quality improvement committee was inactive, and the SIMS visit really triggered and kind of a revival of the teams, and they used the topic of linkage as one of the topics for quality improvement. And you see here they went through the brainstorming exercise, did the root cause analysis, and measured the process and improved actually linkage from 65% in March to 90% in September of last year. This graph shows you the workflow of remediation identified issues and gaps during the SIMS visit and how it is a part of the partner monitoring process. I'm using like the mouse here. So there is, after the SIMS assessment, individual site corrective action plans and site improvement plans are developed by the implementing partner in collaboration with the activity managers. This established timelines and milestones. The partner then works with the site through their regular interaction with the site on improvement and communicates this improvement over time to the activity manager. There is a follow-up assessment after 6 months, where's the mouse here, by the implementing partner, focusing on the initial identified yellows and reds, where the partner is using the SIMS tool and assesses these standard again and then reports these results to the activity manager. Data management systems and analytic tools have been developed by the Interagency Collaborative for Program Improvement. This is a body that was established by the Office of the Global AIDS Coordinator under Ambassador Burks in last fiscal year and really brings together data management and analytic experts as well as technical experts from all six implementing PEPFAR agencies. And they come up with several tools and have really increased and expanded the use of data for decision making in our PEPFAR programs. The dashboard allows very easily for our country offices to look at the program, the partner, and down to the site level and work with our partners to make the necessary changes and course corrections if needed. So overall, the SIMS data are served as a basis for program improvement. Really, what Ambassador Burks said this morning too, by going to the sites, having our personnel, ears and eyes at the site, that really kind of led to a much broader and better understanding of the quality of the program, the challenges that we are facing, and makes a much more informed dialogue with our implementing partner of how to improve. It also identifies areas of need for more intensified assistance and for improved quality that may be later on the on higher level of the health system. So maybe in general, new quality initiatives or quality management initiatives would result on that level. Thank you very much for your attention.
Good afternoon. Just checking out because it was a long lunch, I know. So anyway, so I'm happy to come back and talk a little bit about New York Links with you. New York Links is a somewhat complex initiative, and I'm going to try to digest it in the next 10 to 12 minutes. But hopefully it will also stimulate some thoughts and questions that you might have that we'll be able to chat about. And I'll be here the next 2 days. Also, I'm happy to talk to anybody further about this. So New York Links is an initiative now in New York State that, let me just say, our overall goals are to improve linkage to care, improve retention in care, and improve viral load suppression. And the mission of New York Links is to spread innovative solutions for improving linkage and retention in HIV care that support the delivery of routine, timely, and effective care for people with AIDS, with the idea HIV and AIDS, and we want to bridge systemic gaps between HIV-related services and achieve better outcomes through improving systems for monitoring, recording, and accessing information about retention, linkage, and viral load suppression in New York. So that's our formal mission statement. What does that really mean? It means that we actually are going to drive into communities and get them to work together, applying principles of quality improvement to improve their systems and have them actually do that. So we began as a HRSA SPINS grant, and this was one that was targeted specifically to states, focusing on linkage, improving linkage to care and retention using the QI model. So it's the same breakthrough series model I showed this morning where teams come together, they do some problem solving, talk to each other about their problems, then they go back and work and try to improve, reporting very regularly on measures. And the idea was to plan for sustainability. So the key components for us were to build and develop regional networks to bridge the gap between the health providers and the public health system. Again, this was voluntary. Oops. This is not my computer. And we're down to 6%. Okay. Be a quick talk. So I was like, so providers and consumers are involved in planning and implementing regional networks, and we try to make surveillance data accessible. So one of the goals that HRSA had was how do we take the surveillance data coming at the from the national level, the state level, and get it used at the local level? And so that, again, is part of the goals. Are we good?
He's got to plug this in the back of
here. Okay. Let's see, what else can I remember? So,
I actually have to pull the one up on my computer here. In the meantime, we'll see who's faster.
Okay, so I'm going to pick up here a little bit, and then we'll come back to the graphics in a minute. And the idea was to really focus on having partnerships in the communities and maximize peer learning between providers.
So I'll skip the maps, and I'll show them to you in a minute. But when we go into a region, the idea is to take all the medical providers and the non-medical organizations within the area.
Okay. Thank you.
Anyway, so here's where we are now, just to show you. So we've now spread from the original sites, which were in Upper Manhattan and Western New York, into the Mid-Hudson region and the Bronx and Central New York, and our plan now, and Queens, and we're going to be rolling out into Brooklyn and upstate and northeastern New York. And so we want to engage all the organizations. I would say that we have not been successful in engaging private practitioners. It's our goal to do that, but it's been extremely challenging to do that. And to get all types of organizations to the extent that we can and have different individuals from those organizations participate. And so that we can have both a community-oriented and an organizational-oriented approach happening at the same time to improvement driven by data and using QI strategies to improve and, as I mentioned, peer learning. So we ask each organization to identify their team and leadership support to come to the meetings, to generate their own data and report on it regularly, and to use QI. And then, like I talked about this morning, we provide coaches in each region so sites that need support can benefit from the QI coach. So we have an online reporting database that we use for many different things, and we've adapted that so it has the New York Links measures. And so the sites can report in, and I can't really see, okay. They can report on the linkage and retention measures and then viral load suppression. So as I mentioned, one of the things we aim to do is integrate surveillance into the process. We have people both in the city and the state health departments that produce regional cascades to bring to these meetings, which I will show you in a minute. And then as we have been winding down the grant period, the governor announced the End of AIDS initiative, and New York Links became a great platform to drive that forward with communities. So the measures that we use here are the standard, again, the HAB measures that I think you're familiar with, except that we ask community organizations to also report whether their patients or their clients have had a medical visit, so to stay on top of that. Here's an example of data from Rochester where they've made a lot of improvement. I think they've definitely been our star, as I showed this morning. I showed you this morning as well with the improvement in linkage. So what happens when we bring the teams together, right? So here are these providers who ostensibly know each other. They've been working in the HIV field together for 20 years, and they come together. There were some who didn't know each other, and we ask them to map out the processes for linkage to care and navigation. And this is their map, okay? So of all these different agencies that interact with the health facilities, they produce, you know, what we call in the trade a spaghetti diagram. And there's one for Nassau, Suffolk, and Long Island. Each region pretty much comes up with the same thing. And so you can really understand the need for system-level work. I think I showed this morning as well, too. The idea is to have the data at each level come forward. And we have the state cascade. And then what we've tried to do is also help providers understand what their surveillance data and their cascade data mean, how it's different from the data they report in for quality of care, and why their numbers might be different in the statewide cascade, the regional cascade, and in their clinical performance data. And so we've been producing this for them so they can try to understand the differences and then figure out what's actionable. This was one of the health centers. I think I showed that this morning, too. Here's an example from Mount Sinai Hospital, which is now Mount Sinai Mega Hospital, I guess, for lack of a better word. It's expanded and taken over about 5 major hospitals where they've produced their own cascades for every single facility. I think I showed you the domain. We do have a communication platform so that providers can interact and get information directly on our website. There's a blog that our program manager puts together. And then we have a webinar series in order, again, to provide technical support. So some of the successes that we've had, the Upper Manhattan group has been very, very active for 4 years, has an active consumer team, and they are now taking the lead in managing their own meetings. And so they've set their own target goals for measures, which I'll show you on the next slide. Monroe County has the typo there, developed its own plan to end the epidemic, which is called McPete, Monroe County Plan to End the Epidemic. And they are also taking ownership of this process in the community. A number of facilities have used different QI methods to improve their viral load suppression. Monroe County, I talked about the crisis captain model, and we've just seen enhanced relationships between the medical providers and the community-based organizations. And the goal, again, is to have each community set their own goals and targets. This is the Upper Manhattan group, and they've got their own goals for linkage and retention, and very specifically wanted to focus on specific populations that are they feel are not getting adequate care, in particular in their region, focusing on young MSM of color, transgendered individuals, people with mental health and substance use issues, and women of color. So this has been an enormous opportunity for us to partner with our colleagues at New York City, who I don't think are here this afternoon. But we have had an amazing change in our relationship, where I think we work very seamlessly together in this. And the city had also been initiating their own campaign to promote testing, which they called in the boroughs, Bronx Knows, Brooklyn Knows, and so forth. And then thanks to Dimitri Daskalakis, whom some of you know, we've really worked closely together with our teams, and we're bringing Knows and Links together. And since there are often multiple meetings in the community, one for Knows, one for Links, and now we have this End the Epidemic forum that meets, we're working with the communities to come up with strategies to streamline the meetings, combine things, and work together to span across the entire cascade together. And it's been a really great partnership. So finally, as I mentioned, the state has focused on ending the epidemic. And our three goals are about identifying people who remain undiagnosed to get linked to care, linking and retaining those with HIV in care so they can be suppressed, and to provide PrEP. And of course, the second pillar that the governor has supported really relates to New York Links. Just the photos again of Governor Cuomo and Charles King, who has been was one of the chair of our councils, releasing the blueprint. And so we are now really moving forward very aggressively, I would say, to work with the communities to try to end the epidemic. So thanks. Yeah.
Thank you. So I'm gonna close things out. We had a nice global perspective, program-wide, in terms of using data, looking at data, and then heard from New York State, where there's just such progressive leadership in terms of government and public health and resources and pushing. And I'm going to share our experience in Alabama, and it's very much a grassroots experience. And I think hopefully we'll round out the talks, and then we'll engage in conversation in a panel discussion. And again, the title of the session was Actioning the Data, Multisectoral Perspectives on Using CQI Data in HIV Medicine. So here's a bit of the Alabama experience, and by no means is this comprehensive. And I start off with the care continuum. We've seen this many times. In this iteration, the idea of engaged in care has been collapsed into a single bar, and we see this huge drop-off of where half of folks who are diagnosed with HIV in the U.S. are not engaged in regular care. And I show this is how we've kind of conceptualized and studied this process for the last decade. And I use this to show, in terms of engagement in care, the way we've thought about it and operationalized it. And I think one of the ways our field really challenges, challenged, is that we don't have a shared taxonomy. Folks use these terms very interchangeably. But for purposes of this talk, we'll share, for engagement in care, we really focus on these three distinct but interrelated steps. And we're focusing on medical care for the purposes of care engagement, but linkage, retention, and re-engagement. And again, I know many others have used other operational definitions, but for us, the broader umbrella of engagement in care encompasses these steps of linkage, retention, and re-engagement. And at our clinic, the 1917 Clinic in Birmingham has had a long-standing history of continuous quality improvement, generating reports for a number of metrics. And I just point out one, which is looking at patients who were not seen in the last 12 months. So you could see from 2010 to 2016, our clinic has grown dramatically, Part of that was due to the closure of a large Part C clinic. So you see this big bump in January 2013 when we had about 800 patients transfer in. One of the most striking numbers to me, so when I first got to UAB in 2006, we had about 1,200 patients. One of the most striking numbers year after year after year is that we have between 8 and 12% of patients who were seen the previous year, not seen the next year. And it's just been consistent. And it's really interesting across different clinic settings, that bar is at a different level. But when you ask clinics about their kind of loss to follow-up 12-month, you see very consistent numbers over time in many different settings. And I want to speak to the idea of going from one clinic's data to a larger regional quality group. And Ashley Tarrant shared this slide. So in the last several years, I had the great pleasure of working with this group that brings together 10 different Ryan White-funded clinics throughout the state of Alabama, come together quarterly, and have this mission shown here. So our quality management group exists to ensure that those living with HIV/AIDS in the state of Alabama receive quality health care through collaboration of healthcare partners throughout the state, aims to continuously improve the quality of HIV care, consistent with recognized national standards and current HIV research. And Bruce and his group has provided a lot of oversight and leadership to help to get this group going, but it's become a very, very functional group that comes together. And he showed this earlier from Thrive Alabama, so in Huntsville, just kind of showing what their clinic-level data, their clinic-level continuum looks like. But these 10 different clinics, we aggregate our data. So quarterly, we come together. We've agreed upon different metrics. One is retention in care based upon the HRSA-HAV measure, which is the IOM measure and the White House measure, looking at did someone have at least two visits 12 months apart, 3 months apart over a 12-month period. And you see quite a bit of variability across the clinics. And you know, the purpose of this meeting is to kind of share best practices, understand how which clinics are doing better, worse, and kind of talking through things. But one thing that's always struck us, I think both at the local clinic level and also at the quality group, and I think anyone in the field realizes this, when you see these numbers, anywhere between 40% and 10% of folks who are lost to clinic, it's always begged the question, are these patients merely lost to clinic or truly lost to care? And this is a question I think all of us working out of clinics has asked for a long time and really struggled with this because we didn't have the tools to know, to really systematically track down and get a sense for the 10%, 8% that we haven't seen from 1 year to the next, how many might be in care somewhere else. And this is an idea that's longstanding, I think, throughout the country. And this is an idea that we call Birmingham Unite. It was going to be a unified network to integrate testing and engagement. It was 2009. This is actually an unsuccessful grant application, and I show it to show that from failure, you can set a foundation to lead to success later on. So I had the discussion, and with the client centered, we had all the major medical clinics, the local health department, and the major CBOs working together. And the idea that came up was there's someone that I might not have seen for 12 months in my practice, and when they re-engage in care with me, I find out that each and every month they were at one of our CBOs to get help with their utility bill or food supplements, and there just wasn't a good system to integrate how we were communicating with these shared clients. So this was an idea for a health information exchange. We were going to compile our data, integrate. Again, it wasn't funded, but for us laid the foundation. Other good examples of health information exchanges. But again, recognizing this loss to clinic versus loss to care has been an age-old problem globally and really, really challenging to address. And this is what our cascade looks like in Alabama, Public Health Area 4, very similar to other areas. And looking historically, I think a part of the challenge has been there have been agencies working in the community, typically the health department, community-based organizations, and the clinics working in the clinic setting, and really haven't had a lot of functional interaction. As was said by Bruce, folks know each other. They like each other. You get letters of support the day before a grant goes in. But functionally, really weren't integrated and working in a way that really kind of had these clients who were getting seen one place, not the other. And to me, for quite some time, this has been the leading edge of where we are in terms of addressing the epidemic is how do we bridge the community and the clinic? So how do we bridge the initial linkage and the re-engagement? But we've got to do a better job. This is, in my mind, the critical interface and the great, great challenge we have to addressing the epidemic both domestically as well as globally. And I think the real game changer domestically, this is April 30th, 2014, probably can't see on the bottom, but Amy Lansky, when she was at CDC, sent this letter out about data to care. And hopefully by now everyone is familiar with data to care. And data to care was a really big paradigm shift, and I think a lot of courage and credit to the CDC. Historically, it was surveillance data in, goes in these big giant epi reports, and never goes back out. And the idea was using surveillance data at an individual level to inform practice and policies and interventions. So the idea of local health departments using surveillance data, so the idea that viral loads are now reported as a proxy for a care visit, so that if someone does not have a viral load reported, they're considered to be out of care, using that not just to make a nice cascade figure as a population level, but for that individual to go and do outreach or other interventions to bring them back into care. And again, I think a really tremendous effort by the CDC launching this, pushing this. Some states and jurisdictions have more experience or are ahead of the curve, a lot to learn from them. But I think this is the wave of the future in terms of really addressing linkage and re-engagement in care through these partnerships across the community and the clinic. As Bruce alluded to, I couldn't agree more. And the way this operationalized for us, this is kind of the follow-up. So our Birmingham Unite was not successful. In January 2013, with NMAC support, we had an Ending AIDS in Alabama community dialogue. And part of what emerged from that was this Jefferson County Community Coalition. So the same clinics, the same community partners, the local health department, the state health department coming together saying, you know, we've got the tools, we've got the resources, we share the clients, we're all very passionate, working hard, but we're not working very efficiently or effectively, and we've got to come together and figure out how to do things better. And so came together in March 2013, have met monthly ever since then. And again, part of the success of this group, I think, has been the grassroots nature. It wasn't a funder or a sponsor or a planning council saying, you have to meet. It was folks coming together on the ground saying, our cascade is as terrible as everybody else's. We're all working really hard. If we don't change what we're doing and expect a different result, we're kidding ourselves. And so this is part of the group, and I've loved being part of this group. It's been just the most humbling and rewarding experience, and have goals, have bylaws, and you can see from these goals, they're overarching. It's improving health outcomes, prevention, treatment, and research, but also focusing on social and economic justice, community collaboration for parity, inclusion, representation, and importantly, looking for long-term ways to sustain ourselves and keep going. And in August 2014, a little over a year after we formed, this group, and it's the power of, I think, the group voice and the group coalition, met with our Alabama Department of Public Health, and these folks are pictured here, and really had been asking a lot of questions about data to care, and saying we need to bring data to care to Alabama, and had just a wonderful discussion with our leader of HIV services, surveillance services, and our surveillance director. And at the end of it, I'm a big picture guy, I said, we're taking a picture, because this is going to mark the day. We're going to look back at August 2014 and say, this is the day we turned the corner in Alabama. This is the day we came together about data to care, and we're going to look back on this and celebrate this day. And a few months later, Allison Smith, who was surveillance director, convened folks from throughout the state at a library in Alabama to talk about data to care and how the Alabama Department of Public Health was going to improve care and prevention. And I will say a lot of credit in that they are very under-resourced, and there was no direct funding for this. I mean, Allison was the lone epidemiologist for the state, so I think great vision, great leadership from ADPH to say, even though we aren't directly funding, this is the right thing to do. Even though our resources are limited, we're going to do this, and a lot of credit to the leadership. And it was very simple. We've heard this before. The idea was healthcare providers would share a patient list. I showed you, 8 to 12% of our folks we lose every year, for, you know, out of care for 12 months. We would then share that list with the health department and share their identifiers, and then they would go and cross-reference with their surveillance data and give us back an updated list. And so looking back, you know, around this time, shared a list of roughly 300 patients as a pilot run. I've been going down to Montgomery about every 4 to 6 weeks, just touching base, meeting with folks, having that really important FaceTime. And we tried this last fall. Took a little while the first time to process the data, but got the data back, and it was really interesting. So the idea was they would then cross-reference our list of patients out of care with surveillance. Again, if there's a viral load from Huntsville or from Tennessee, then they assume someone's in care. There's no need for us to go and do outreach and find them. If folks had moved out of state, died, or they couldn't locate. And our first feedback was really interesting. It turned out that out of about roughly 270 people, only 40% were truly out of care. A full 50% were in care elsewhere. So here we are for decades, 25 years as a clinic, not knowing, and at least this first pass, half of the folks who we haven't seen for 12 months are being seen somewhere else. Fantastic that someone's in care. About 8% had died, and very few couldn't be located. And again, this is just our first pass. This data is hot off the presses as of a few weeks ago, but I think is the way, you know, for us going forward. And now in 2016, Birmingham Unite looks a lot different, and it's really cool to see all these partners come together. And Sharon Jordan, who's our director of HIV prevention services, had this African proverb, which really seemed to fit well with our kind of spider web in Birmingham Unite, that when spider webs unite, we can tie up a lion. And it's been really, again, so humbling to be part of this. And for me personally, this was a day we met with the frontline providers. I mentioned this morning just how humbling it is to meet with frontline providers. But to go and share with them the updated strategy, to share with them data to care, to share with them the new CDC high-impact prevention interventions and the role they play, I mean, it's incredible how empowering it is to the folks on the ground who ultimately are going to make the difference with data to care, with linkage and re-engagement and care. This was an event we had last fall. And the turnout was remarkable, you know, from DIS officers to link coordinators, peer mentors, and just a wonderful afternoon getting together. Folks who said, we've talked on the phone for 10 years, I've never met you before. And just how powerful it is to just bring folks together in shared space. And to share with them, here it is. I mean, on that whiteboard in the back, here's all the tools and resources we now have in Birmingham to really address our epidemic, to address our cascade. And again, because of many, many folks. So in terms of next steps for data to care in Alabama, this is the beauty of having that regional quality group. This group already is used to collating data, capturing data the same way. So we told ADPH, tell us how you want the list to get sent to you. We'll send it the exact same way. We'll make it really easy. So when you get a list from any of these 10 clinics, it's the same information, same columns, same formatting. So the idea now is to expand the re-engagement program to the other clinics in this regional quality group. So instead of just being Birmingham Unite, it's now Alabama Unite. And these clinics collectively account for more than 90% of persons living with HIV receiving their care. So really big potential for impact. We're going to work with them to capture and report on our re-engagement and care efforts. So we got this list back, 40% weren't in care. Could we contact folks, get them in care, so we could have that data to know how well we're doing as a state and across agencies. And then next steps are to expand to linkage to care. So a lot of our community-based organization partners do a lot of testing, and they have the same challenge. I've given someone a positive test result. They tested positive. I referred them for care. I don't know systematically if they made it to care or not. So now the opportunity, if you've provided testing services, to send, here's the folks we tested positive the last 6 months, and get back. Here are the folks we have evidence are linked to care. Here are the folks we have no viral loads for. And then kind of going back to that testing provider to go and do that initial linkage to care. And then as a next step, and this really dovetails with what Bruce talked about, going from kind of local to state to regional, we've been involved with the Southeast AIDS Education Training Center, has had a big push with the restructuring for practice transformation. So in Birmingham, we've had the real pleasure of leading this practice transformation work group for the Southeast AETC. So it's based out of the star is Nashville. We're the blue dot in Alabama. And then there's the local partners of these red boxes. But then those purple triangles are 12 different clinics across the Southeast that we're going to work with over the next year on practice transformation. So they're either clinics already providing HIV services that want to elevate their level of services, or they're community health centers that aren't providing HIV services that want to expand to provide services, very much focused on the continuum of care. So part of the vision is saying we've had such good success in our state with this Alabama Regional Quality Group. Can we expand it now through this CTEC to have a practice transformation virtual quality group? And might that virtual quality group similarly interface with public health departments to think about data to care? So I think, again, going from local to state to regional, some of the work that's been done in Alabama and throughout the Southeast region. So many, many folks to thank at the 1917 Clinic. It's just an incredible place to work. The ADPH, again, incredible leadership and vision in doing this work. The regional quality group, similarly, just incredible leadership. And our community coalition has been just such a wonderful group of folks coming together with great passion to find solutions. So with that, I will close, and we have 15 minutes for discussion. So now it's your time to interact. Would ask folks to please come to the microphone, introduce yourself, where you're from, share your experiences, ask questions of the panelists. But again, the focus on actioning the data, how data are being used. So would welcome folks to come up and share their thoughts. And as we're waiting, I will kick things off. So one thing I talked to Bruce at the break about was how I've been impressed with the infographics and these dashboards and how approachable they are in recent years. And historically, you got these EPI reports that were like an encyclopedia and tables that were just dense and hard to get through. So I guess the question for both of you is, in terms of showing the work you've done with these dashboards and with these report cards and things, how much do you engage the actual target sites and their staff in designing or thinking about what those dashboards should look like to try to get buy-in and uptake of those really important visuals?
Well, so that's a good question. I didn't think that's what you were going to ask. But, it's interesting because in the past when we've produced reports, we definitely have engaged the community in helping design them. And I think because of the cascade, we have been less outgoing, if you will, to get input about that. Although once the reports go out, then we usually have feedback sessions with each community, and then they'll propose suggestions on how they want that modified. So there is an opportunity for feedback, but usually the system now for production has gotten so complex that we haven't done that like we used to in the past. But we should.
For us right now, the dashboards are created on the state side. But as Ambassador Burks mentioned this morning, there is a much more formal process now to engage civil society and community and looking together at our data. And this is a process that is a quarterly process, which is called the PORT, the PEPFAR quarterly report process. And in that, we're really making sure that not only we are listened to the communities and the civil society, but also capacitate them to use the data. So there's kind of like a two-way that we approach.
Yeah, one other quick comment, which is that, you know, now that we're having facilities make their own cascades, they're all different. Yeah. And so it's really interesting. It allows for creativity in terms of what works at each facility. I didn't have time to show that many, but it's interesting to see how different they can be.
Yeah. Right. Comment over.
Yeah, so it's a great question. So the question was, you know, once you engage in these data-to-care activities and now you have your true out-of-care lists, do the clinics, do the providers have the resources to engage in those re-engagement activities, or is there an opportunity for partnership? And these are the conversations we're having now, and I think historically our clinic, like many clinics, does really, really well inside the four walls of the clinic. But in terms of our outreach, and some clinics have wonderful outreach, but our outreach into the community is not nearly as strong as our public health and our community-based organization partners. So part of what we're trying to do in working through some of both the legal, HIPAA, ethical aspects, having those really important conversations on the front end, including consumers in those conversations, is talking about once we've exhausted our within-clinic resources of identifying folks, can we, through these CDC high-impact prevention grants, where we now have 9 new FTE link coordinators who work in the community, you know, boots on the ground, you know, can we, you know, ask them to then, through these partnerships, through this coalition, to really kind of go and do that approach and try to do that re-engagement activity? We do have that with our health department. We have a number of peer mentors, and they're wonderful, but there's only so much capacity that any one peer mentor can do. So we're really trying to push now and say, we have these wonderful community-based organization partners that have this high-impact prevention funding that includes data to care, that have staff, lots of staff, who are well-trained, who are well-integrated in the community. Might they be the ideal people to kind of truly do that outreach once our clinic has exhausted resources? That's been our experience and the approach that we're planning to take.
So one more, just add to that one thing if I can. So in addition to the traditional CDC resources that we have in the health departments, and with apologies to those states that are not expanding Medicaid, one of the opportunities, the programs that have been created through Medicaid for people who in New York join what are called health homes, and they have a care coordinator that is not unique to HIV, but that's somebody who can be tapped, as well as the managed care plans and Medicaid that can be tapped. So I think is an important opportunity to link up this activity together with the Medicaid people. Yeah. In your state, to the extent that that's possible.
Yes. Yeah, I think it's a point well taken, and I think as part of the strategy in that fourth goal, the enhanced coordination, we're seeing HRSA and CDC integrate and trickling down to having prevention and treatment plans that are not separate prevention and treatment plans, but that are combined plans. So I think your points are well taken. And there's a lot of arbitrary, artificial, historical lines. And again, to me, it comes to this, you know, you either work in the community or you work in the clinic, and it's just very artificial. The folks we're working with are navigating across this, and the better integrated we are in terms of our services and funding and reimbursement and allowing for shared information, with appropriate legal, HIPAA, ethical considerations, we could do a much better job serving, and there's many great examples around the country, but these points very well taken. All right, other questions, other experiences in other states, countries, jurisdictions with this kind of work? Yes.
You know, should go to a mic.
Yeah. So for those that couldn't hear, just, you know, audio speaking to the experience in Rhode Island and just how when these data systems start speaking to each other, you start identifying some of the deficiencies or misclassification across the data system. So, and then we've had the same experience. You start learning things where one system might say someone's out of care, but you as the clinic know they're in care because you saw them, and whether there was a delayed viral load report or what the case may be. So again, just with these synergies and sharing of data, and I think this is experience Matt Golden in Seattle, others have spoken about, when you start using this surveillance data for programmatic purposes and integrating with the clinic data and then sometimes the claims data, the first thing you do is really learn some of your flaws and deficiencies, and you actually improve those systems and make them better. So I think that's a point really well taken. Dick, yes? Yeah, so for those that couldn't hear, Dick, self-identified curmudgeon, talked about, are we measuring the right things with doctor visits? I mean, so someone can go to their provider visits but not pick up medicines. Should we actually be measuring pharmacy visits? And I think in terms of the taxonomy, what we measure is interesting. I know globally a lot of the really good work has been done looking at pharmacy visit follow-up and missed pharmacy refill visits. And I think Ambassador Birx this morning really touched upon what to me was a really key, what seems relatively simple but just makes so much sense, this kind of disconnect between the medical visit interval and the pharmacy visit interval, whether they're located, co-located. So I think good foods for thought, and still speaks to me, this field has emerged so rapidly and we lack this shared taxonomy. So it does become challenging. And sometimes you see these apple to orange comparisons that are not fair and not justified. So I'm not sure how we get around that and fix that. This is probably a good venue to try to do that. But I would suggest that we need a more consistent and shared taxonomy. Bruce?
Yeah, hi. And also just, you know, as we start looking at other large data sources, whether they're large data warehouses or claims databases in Medicaid, trying to actually sort out what kind of visit you had and whether that relates to being retained or not is really messy. So medication possession ratios become the equivalent of pharmacy pickups as a way to look at it. So I think a really important point that you made.
Yeah, I think Amanda. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so for those that couldn't hear, Amanda was talking about the DC experience and that this phenomenon called churn, where you have folks who, you know, are frequently falling out of care, resurfacing, falling in and out of care. And in the DC experience, when they looked at those kind of churn patients cycling in and out of care based upon lab data versus folks who remained in care, they didn't observe differences in viral suppression. So, you know, just kind of questioning some of these measures we have and metrics, none of them are perfect, I think, is part of the take home. And just trying to think about the number of data systems available to us, integrating, you know, it's not just the clinic and surveillance data. If you can get insurance data, claims data, pharmacy data. There was some wonderful work last year in Virginia where they actually partnered with the Department of Corrections, and were able to link up with and cross-reference among folks, you know, who were out of care from HIV. How many were in jail? How many were in prison? So I think we're seeing, you know, this is such a nascent field, and in terms of implementation science, how data to care is done, how this is operationalized, best practices. Hopefully the next several years, this will be the venue where we really see those results and help to move the field forward. I think with that will be the closing word. We're at 3:15. I want to thank our panelists. I think just fantastic presentations. And we'll transition to the next panel discussion.